Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral arguments this morning in the March term is Alfred Boneshirt et al. Versus Joyce Hazeltine and other officials of the State of South Dakota. This comes to this court on certification from the United States District Court of South Dakota. For the petitioners, the State of South Dakota would be John Guin, an Assistant Attorney General of Peer, and for the respondents, Mr. Patrick Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Duffy, you'll be doing the presentation for your client this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right. The record should show that the, and Mr. Brian Sells, is that your... All right. Records should show also that the court did invite participation by the United States, and they apparently opted not to participate. With that, Mr. Guin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. As the court mentioned, this case is indeed here on an order of this court accepting certification of a question of law from the Federal District Court. Facts of this case are relatively simple. In 2001, the legislature reapportioned the state and, along with the state, districts 26 and 27. In 2004, the federal district court held that the reapportionment was invalid under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as it applied to districts 26 and 27, further held that districts 26 and 27 had to be reapportioned. The question then was raised in district court as to whether the legislature could itself accomplish that apportionment. The discussion focused on Article 3, Section 5. Article 3, Section 5 provides that the legislature shall apportion every 10 years after 1991. If the legislature does not adopt an apportionment by December 1st of the target year, the Supreme Court, this court, has 90 days to make an apportionment. So the issue which was certified to this court can be reduced to this question. Can the legislature in 2005 enact a valid legislative reapportionment consistent with Article 3, Section 5 of the Constitution in view of the district court's finding of the invalidity of the 2001 apportionment? The most basic principle, of course, regarding this case and any case of South Dakota constitutional interpretation is set out in the 2000 opinion of the court, of this court. The legislature has the power to legislate on any matter unless the Constitution forbids the exercise of that power. Mr. Boneshirt, therefore, must demonstrate that there is a constitutional restriction on the legislature's power to redistrict. The burden is on Mr. Boneshirt to show that there is no reasonable doubt that the proposed redistricting violates the South Dakota Constitution. Your Honors, I'd like to turn to the first principle, what we regard as the first principle regarding the duty to apportion. And we believe that the first principle is that the legislature has a continuing duty to apportion until it adopts a valid reapportionment. History and precedent tell us that, and they tell us that from a century. In 1901, the legislature was required to apportion by the South Dakota Constitution, but it did not. In 1903, it did. And in 1933, this court essentially validated that action. In 1931, 30 years later, the legislature was required to adopt an apportionment. It did not. In 1933, this court held the legislature had a continuing duty to adopt an apportionment until it accomplishes that duty. I'd like to move now to the closer to the present era.
Mr. Guin, though, those cases involved a total failure to act.
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
And so what's the distinction between total failure to act and an action which may or may not be an apportionment that may or may not be valid?
That exactly is this distinction, Your Honor. A total failure to act and an invalid apportionment, we believe, are the same thing. And why do we say that? Because in 2000, after the legislature had apportioned in 1991 and 1996, then it reapportioned, so the issue came before the court as to whether it could. This court reaffirmed the principle that the failure to perform the duty to apportion didn't cancel the duty to apportion, but it found, and here we think is the critical holding, it found because the legislature did perform its constitutional duty in 1991, it lacked the constitutional authority to make another apportionment until the next federal census. Exactly what the court was saying. So what the court resolved was the tension between the continuing duty, which it found to exist in 2000, the continuing constitutional duty, and the accomplishment of that duty.
Could the legislature declare its own previous apportionment invalid?
I think the meaning of the court's 2000 decision is no. because I think that what the legislature was trying to do, was trying to say in 1996, is that it didn't believe that it had done the right thing. And so I think what this court's holding in 2000 indicates is the answer to that question is no, it has to be a judicial holding. So if this court held that because a constitutional duty had been satisfied, there was no continuing duty. So that's the way it reconciled these principles. The present controversy, as the court pointed out, is different. The legislature did attempt to perform its constitutional duty in 2001. It did adopt apportionment. But in 2004, a court with jurisdiction did find the legislative apportionment in 2001 was invalid as a matter of law. And then the question is, and the central question is, what's the meaning of this with regard to South Dakota constitutional law? It seems to us it means the South Dakota legislature has not yet performed its constitutional duty, because its constitutional duty was to enact a valid legislative apportionment. It has to be that for two reasons, logic and precedent. Logic, surely the voters in adopting Article 3, Section 5, and readopting Article 3, Section 5, and amending Article 3, Section 5, placed a duty of enacting a valid legislative apportionment on the legislature. There's no duty to enact an invalid apportionment. Second, precedent. This court's 2000 decision, we think, says this. In paragraph 10, it says, it finds that the general rule which it follows is that once a valid apportionment is enacted, the legislature cannot act again until 10 years as it had expired. And supported by six cases in a treatise. The quotation of the word valid simply is not inadvertent. And the result is that the 2005 legislature has not yet performed its constitutional duty to enact a valid apportionment law. That brings us back to the first principle. First principle is there's a duty to enact a valid apportionment, and it continues until it's accomplished, and therefore we believe that today the legislature has the power, the constitutional power, to enact a valid apportionment act, and it will continue to have that power until a valid apportionment act is adopted.
Maybe it goes without saying, but I take it Judge Schreier found that the previous apportionment was void from its inception.
Found it was invalid.
It's never been valid. It's always.
Yes.
Is that the technical word she used?
Excuse me, Leon?
Invalid. Did Judge Schreier use the word invalid, unconstitutional void, or what
exactly? I believe she used the word invalid, Your Honor. And in fact, that's precisely the words that counsel at the opposing table have used in 2001. In June 9, 2000, on page 8 of their brief in Emery v. Hunt, which is the case we've been talking about, said they told this court, of course, the legislature could have adopted a new plan in 1996 if a court of competent jurisdiction had ruled the 1991 plan was invalid. And so we believe that on the central question of this case, the opposing counsel have already indicated their agreement with us.
In a different case,
Your Honor. Mr. Bonestreet essentially has two overall responses. The first, the main response, centers on a constitutional amendment which was defeated in November of 2002. According to its title, this particular amendment was proposed to clarify the responsibility of the legislature to provide for its own apportionment. The text says, if any federal or state court invalidates an apportionment made by the legislature shall make a new apportionment. That amendment was defeated. Mr. Bonestreet, from this defeated amendment, makes this interesting argument. He says it's clear from the failure of this amendment that the people of South Dakota, here's his words, do not want the legislature to have the authority to reapportion. We find that to be an extraordinary argument, and we find it to reveal a profound misunderstanding of South Dakota law. The first question regarding a defeated amendment, we think, is what would a reasonably well-informed voter have known about, have thought about this 2002 amendment? And we stress as a matter of law that the voter is deemed to be well-informed. In fact, Cummings v. Mickelson says a person voting on a constitutional amendment has to be presumed to know the reasons for the recommended changes. Okay, so where does a prospective voter go to get reasons? Well, the most obvious place is the Secretary of State's pamphlet. That's the Secretary of State under 12-1323 publishes an explanation of the matters that appear on the ballot. It's got statewide distribution, it's on the web, easily available. Proponents and opponents can put down what they think the amendment is going to do. Only the proponents put in an explanation in this particular case. What the proponent said is that this amendment would clarify the constitutional provision so as to allow the legislature, in the event a apportionment is invalidated, to act quickly. It added that clarification is necessary and urged the people to vote for it. So that's one thing. Second thing, a voter could have looked at House Resolution 1007, and it says its purpose is to clarify the responsibility of the legislature. Also set out the text. The text says the legislature is required to apportion if an apportionment is found invalid. On the ballot itself, essentially the same thing. The purpose of the amendment is to clarify the responsibility, and then includes the text of the amendment. So what would a reasonably well-informed voter have known? Well, he would have known that there's text that said the legislature was required to apportion in the case of an invalidation. He would have known that the Secretary of State and all the other materials sought the voter's vote to clarify the Constitution, and he would have known that the word clarify means to free of confusion. But what would he have lacked? We think in this case, what he lacked was really more important. He would have lacked any argument or proof about why a clarification was necessary. Look at the Secretary of State's explanation, not a word about that. The proponent's explanation in the Secretary of State's pamphlet. He would have lacked any explanation about the nature of the confusion. What does a voter know about the nature of this confusion? Not a thing. Any indication of the intensity of the confusion? It's a little bit confused, it's a lot confused. Exactly what is it that's confused? Voter wouldn't have known that. Any explanation of why the legislature should be required, and that's the word of the text, and the word of the explanation, could be required to apportion. Did it imply that the legislature already had such power and simply wasn't doing it? We don't know. Any assertion in the materials that a neutral body had stated that there was confusion in the matter? And finally, I'd like to drop back a little bit and ask exactly what it was that the voter was asked to do. I think when I pulled back and I asked myself, the voter was asked to step in the shoes of a court. Really was. He was asked to decide that there's some legal ambiguity in some unspecified combination of some unidentified legal documents. Well, the voter doesn't have the documents. He doesn't have the tools to make that kind of legal analysis. He doesn't have the legal training. So how's a reasonable voter going to react? He's going to react by voting against this proposition, and not on the merits, simply because he doesn't have the tools to deal with it.
The old axiom, when in doubt, vote no.
Exactly. That's exactly it. It's the typical way people vote. A reasonable voter could simply well have concluded that the proponents simply had not made their case, could have assumed that he's asked to step in the shoes of a judge, but he didn't have the tools to do it, so didn't understand it, didn't vote. It seems to us that's the most reasonable interpretation. So we're back to the first point. The legislature has the power to act unless some provision of the Constitution prohibits him. A constitutional amendment, which is proposed but doesn't pass, obviously is not a provision of the Constitution which prohibits the legislature from acting. It's a proposal, nothing more. The burden has not been met to show that the legislature cannot act. Mr. Buncher's got a second argument. The second argument is that the 1982 amendment to the Constitution changes everything. And let me recapitulate his argument. It's this. In 1982, a constitutional amendment was adopted. It provided that if the legislature did not apportion by December 1st of every year, of every 10 years, the Supreme Court would have 90 days to apportion. And based on this provision, Mr. Bonshard argues that whatever power the legislature had was transferred to this court on December 1st of 2001. I have two general responses. The first, what was the situation on December 1st, 2001? To our mind, as of that date, the legislature had, to all appearances, fulfilled its constitutional duty. No court had said otherwise. There was no authoritative ruling by a federal state agency or by anybody. And this court had held, in its 2000 opinion of paragraph 8, that once the constitutional duty to apportion is fulfilled, there's no further duty on the part of the legislature to apportion or on anybody else. So as of 2001, what was transferred to the court, to this court? We'd say nothing. What's the converse? What is Mr. Bonshirt saying? Mr. Bonshirt seems to be saying that something actually was transferred to this court on December 1st, 2001, the duty to reapportion. If so, we'd say that is an unjustified sort of placement of duty on this court. This court did not do anything for 90 days after December 1st, 2001. We don't know if the intent is to tell the court that it engaged in some kind of dereliction of duty. We certainly hope not. That's one option.
Well, how could we have acted? No court at that point had declared the legislative act invalid.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly, Your Honor. That's the reason there was nothing established, nothing transferred to this court on December 1st, 2001. The second option, Mr. Bonshard said, well, the authority, if this If we take this amendment for what it means, we take the 1982 amendment for what it means, then that means something was transferred to this court. Well, either it was transferred or it was not. If nothing was transferred on December 1st, 2001, then that simply makes his argument facially absurd.
Mr. Guin, doesn't that just leave the federal court then to do the reapportionment?
No, Your Honor. No, because we believe that what happens is that the state, the legislature, has a continuing duty to act until there's a valid apportionment. And so what happens is, I guess the question is, what is the effect then of the provision that transfers or that allegedly transferred the authority to the court on December 1st, 2001? First of all, we don't believe that anything was transferred to this court in 2001 because there was no holding of any court saying that the action of the legislature was invalid. This really goes to the purpose of the backup amendment, of the amendment, of the 1982 amendment, which places the authority in this court to reapportion. Of course, it did not originate in 1982, as Mr. Bonesert's brief seems to indicate. Actually, it originated in 1935. In 1935, this amendment was adopted in reaction to the problem raised by this court in 1933, and of course, that problem was the legislature hadn't redistricted in 1931. So what were the voters trying to do in 1935 when they enacted this original backup amendment? Seems to me they were trying to deal with the problem. What happens if the legislature simply fails to adopt an apportionment, maybe because of partisanship, which is apparently what had happened in 1901, maybe because of their intransigent, maybe because they're neglectful, maybe because they're refusing, maybe because demands of other business, maybe because of deadlock, lots of good or bad reasons. Could be the court simply didn't act. In that case, there was a backup amendment for 30 days in 1982 changed to 90 days. So the question is, what does that backup provision mean today? Does it have any application in a situation in which, one, the legislature did not act promptly, or did act promptly, as here, December 1st has come and gone, as here, 90 days after December 1st, 2001 have come and gone, and 3 years later, a federal court has invalidated the 2001 action of the legislature. And it's our view that the backup provision in that situation, in this situation, is irrelevant. The function of the backup provision was exhausted once the legislature adopted an apportionment plan in 2001. And as we stand here today, it simply has no further application. It's simply inoperative. So we have to return to the first principle. The legislature's got a continuing duty to adopt a valid legislative apportionment. That continues until a valid legislative apportionment is adopted. When we apply that principle, the legislature's got this continuing duty, hasn't adopted an apportionment. The district court has said there's no valid apportionment, and so the legislature has its continuing duty to reapportion. I'd like to talk briefly about the policy underlying the state's argument this morning, and that is whether can a policy be derived from the Constitution as a whole with regard to whether or not the legislature ought to be able to redistrict in this situation? And we think the answer is yes. There are two positions here. There are two visions of the Constitution. The first one is set forth by Mr. Bonesert. He says that the Constitution favors the transfer of a critical state function from an elected body to an unelected federal district court, or maybe to an unelected commission, or maybe to somebody else who's not elected. We don't see any of that in the Constitution, in the South Dakota Constitution. We see a Constitution where power is always as near as possible to the people. In 1897, an initiative and referendum was adopted, simply the closest you can get power to the people. We have a large legislature, 105 members. That means that everybody's got a close connection with their own legislator, very close to power. We have term limits. One of the objectives of term limits is to turn the legislature over so lots of people can be in the legislature. So power is, again, closer to the people. The very first provision of the South Dakota Bill of Rights, Article 6, Section 1, says that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the government. Again, calling for involvement of the people in the legislative process. So we think that there is a policy on how Article 3, Section 5 can be interpreted in harmony with the rest of the Constitution. It favors retention of power closest to the people. In this case, it favors the result that the legislature should be able to apportion after a single federal district court has found a apportionment to violate federal law. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you, Mr. Guin. Mr. Duffy, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. The issue presented by the certified question from the Federal District Court is whether or not the South Dakota legislature has the power to reapportion outside a decennial year after a federal district court has found that the reapportionment plan initially enacted violates the Voting Rights Act. The area under consideration is districts 26 and 27 and other affected areas. I think the law in this case is almost irrefutably clear that the South Dakota legislature does not have that power. And the South Dakota legislature does not have that power for one, I think, key reason, and Mr. Gruen touched upon it in his argument. Power in this state is as close to the people as can possibly be. And we in this room can come up with no better reflection of what the people intended than the vote which took place in 2002 on the amendment to Article 3, Section 5 to the Constitution. What was the amendment that was proposed? I'm going to talk a bit about the history.
Are you suggesting the electorate sat down and read our decision in Emory versus Hunt and made an intelligent choice based on that?
I am suggesting that under the case law of this state, we are to consider the electorate to be informed. Mr. Gruen.
How informed? This would take a fairly sophisticated lawyer who had knowledge of South Dakota constitutional procedures to examine Emory versus Hunt. I bet you could pull a lawyer in off the street, a general practitioner, and they may not understand it. And you're saying that the electorate made an intelligent choice after examining all the constitutional issues involved here, rather than just saying, when in doubt, vote no.
Here's what I'm saying. An informed electorate under the case law in South Dakota would have been presumed to know a couple of things very, very proximate to that 2002 amendment. The first thing the electorate would have known, yes, was that Emory versus Hunt had held, this court had only 2 years prior held, that the South Dakota State Legislature cannot reapportion outside a decennial year, must complete its reapportionment by December 1st of the target year, and if they fail to do so, the power then springs to this court. The second thing of a political nature that would be well known because the South Dakota State Legislature acted for this reason. This amendment was proposed in response to this case. We sued out Boneshirt, and within weeks, the proponents sought to change the Constitution. Here is, I think, the real key.
I got to stop you right there because I think that's what this case comes down to.
Yes, it does.
You used the word change the Constitution. Mr. Gruen emphasizes the word clarify.
Yes.
And as you well know, as a good lawyer, the word clarify has a very special meaning.
It does.
In the law of statutory or constitutional construction.
It does.
So you use the word change, he uses the word clarify.
Yes.
So how do you address that?
I address it because, I'll address it this way. I'll address it in a number of ways. First of all, let's imagine there are three of the proponents of this bill are lawyers. Let's imagine that Mr. Bove, Mr. Michaels, and Ms. Everest took the position before four of the five of you who were circuit court judges that based upon the decision certification in Emory versus Hunt, based upon Kane versus Cundred, with which I know you're familiar, and based upon In re opinion of the judges in 1933, those are controlling precedent. If I, as a lawyer, came to you, Judge Zinner, and said, based upon all of that, it's my position that the South Dakota State Legislature has the power to reapportion in an off-decennial year. I won't say it would be sanctionable, but it would not be anywhere close to an accurate reflection of the law. If I did that to any of you as circuit court judges, you would be immediately suspicious of everything I ever did again. Now, these three lawyers don't have the right to seize from the people the meaning of the Constitution by inserting the word clarification in a ballot explanation. Ample case law supports the idea that even if the legislature as a whole had taken the position that they had that authority, that doesn't remove it from you, and it certainly doesn't remove it from the clear language of the Constitution. The other thing is the clarification language, if it were needed, would only spring into effect in the event that there was some ambiguity in Article 3, Section 5.
Now, you've made numerous references to this court. Are you suggesting we should have acted at the time the number of days ran out because we should have somehow figured out this was invalid, or are you suggesting we act now?
No, I'm suggesting neither.
All right, what are you suggesting then? Who is to make this determination then?
Who will redistrict?
Yes.
Reapportion?
Yes.
Federal District Court Judge Karen Schreier.
Okay.
And Federal District Court Judge Karen Schreier will reapportion for a very good reason. One, it's the controlling precedent of Emery versus Hunt. Two, it's the precedent of Kane versus Cundard. Three, it is the precedent set forth by In Re Opinion of Judges in 1933. And four, the people have spoken. 187,000 to 115,000. Interestingly enough, it wasn't elucidated in the brief, but go back to, since I know many of the players in this case, and you do as well, take a look at Cummings versus Nicholson. Chief Justice Foshan submitted a sworn affidavit about what he said took place during the crafting of the law which was at issue. I know him. I know Mike Driscoll extraordinarily well. Mike Driscoll submitted a sworn affidavit. I know Ron Olinger only by reputation. But these three esteemed members of the bar submitted sworn affidavits that said this is what happened. And this court said that kind of testimony is simply not competent. If that kind of testimony submitted under oath by members of the bar is not competent, Mr. Michaels' idea that this constitutes clarification, which if you took that position at the circuit court level, would never wash.
There's one exception here, though. This the word clarifies in the title.
It is.
It's not just an affidavit bar or an explanation that Mr. Michaels wrote.
It is.
It's in the title, and we look at the title all the time.
Well, you look at the title if there's an ambiguity in the language of the statute. That's the first. Second, you will look at the title, but this court still reserves the right to examine whether or not the context of the title is misleading. And in this case, the clarification language describing what will happen is misleading. Justice Sabres, I believe in a dissent, you noted that amendments to the Constitution are proposed to actually affect a change. If this clarification business, which is brand new, is somehow going to achieve some kind of power, it's going to have to trump a number of established precedents in South Dakota, not the least of which, of course, is certification in Emery versus Hunt.
Now, you just alluded to the vote totals, and obviously the resounding majority said no. Take any position as to the explanation of the Secretary of State on the ballot, because that's what we would assume would have been key in the voters' minds. Support your argument, doesn't make any difference.
I would draw more careful attention and guidance from the Attorney General's explanation.
You're right. The Attorney General writes it, then the Secretary of State puts it on the ballot. I guess I'm corrected, but thank you.
No, I didn't mean that as a correction.
Well, you did. But what... Is there any importance in it?
Well, there's importance in this sense. We're the only state in the nation that allows an attorney general's explanation to appear on the ballot without, in this case it was, but without even the text of the proposed constitutional change being put to the voters. That's how much weight we give to the attorney general's explanation. And when they make an explanation, and there has been litigation about this, they have to be careful. And they speak as the lawyer for the people. And the interesting thing about the Attorney General's explanation is it doesn't say clarification. I don't think, look, this is politics. These lawyers that proposed this clarification language, this is politics. And it's not just politics, it's politics in direct response to Emery versus Hunt, to this court's decision, and in direct response to the filing of this case in Boneshirt. They don't have those proponents of this bill, these three lawyers who helped draft that, cannot trump established South Dakota Supreme Court law by simply saying to the people, tell us, give us an advisory opinion. We already have this power, but clarify it for us. And if you look at Wyatt versus Cundert, there's a section in Wyatt versus Cundert that describes the referendum power in South Dakota as a veto. It is a veto power by the people. The referendum, the clarification analysis falls apart at a number of levels, not the least of which is established South Dakota law. We simply don't use referendum to seek advisory legislative opinions. But even more than that, I admire the draftsman of the title of the bill. It's very clever, but it is too clever by half. The entire state legislature could not rise up and say, in response to Emory versus Hunt, the certification decision, we don't care what you have said. We have this power. We reserve it unto ourselves over the top of Emory versus Hunt, over the top of Kane versus Cundert, over the top of In re opinion of judges, and that's the end of it. Now, that's a blunt statement of what the clarification language is really designed to hide, and had they done that, this court would never have countenanced that. They can't do by elliptical indirection what they definitely could never do head on. And head on, this court has never countenanced the legislature itself seizing such power, much less someone writing the quote, explanation, unquote, for what they say the law is going to do. Justice Gilbertson, the people are presumed, I don't want to start betting on the ignorance of the South Dakota electorate.
Well, I wasn't suggesting they were ignorant. I was just wondering if they had access to all the technical legal materials that would allow them to make a decision you're suggesting occurred. Well, I have a high regard for the voters of this state, but that's why I asked you about the ballot explanation, because what else did they have?
Well, they do have one thing. Under State versus Schwartz, the analysis that you proposed, and the analysis I believe you began with your exegesis of the 1889 Constitutional Convention, and they do have this. They have history. And what's the history in South Dakota? 1933, In re opinion of judges. Wait, I could go back to 1889, and I will do that in a moment. But in 1933, In re opinion of judges, what do the judges say? They say exactly what your first question was. Justice Sinner. They say if there is a complete failure, then the duty continues. Then what takes place? Well, we go to, it's either 1935 or 1936, and the people of South Dakota, in response to that decision, say, we're going to have a backup. If you don't act within 30 days, South Dakota State Legislature, we're going to have a backup, and we're going to put the governor and the Secretary of State and the Attorney General and the head of Department of Public Instruction on the board. And they're going to reapportion. That's the South Dakota way. And we were way, way, way ahead of Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Alabama. I can take you through an exegesis of those opinions where, at least in the Alabama case, which went up under Reynolds versus Sims, the Alabama state legislature simply refused to reapportion for 65 years. 65 years. The state of Oklahoma refused to apportion by 1944 all the way up to statehood. The wisdom of the people of South Dakota was such that they said, right away, we will not tolerate that. And so in 1936, they said, here's a backup provision. In 1982, the language at no other time was removed, but they cinched it up even tighter. The people of South Dakota said, we don't even want politicians in the backup commission, we want this court. The people of South Dakota presume to know their own history, and based upon that history, what the people of South Dakota are saying to the South Dakota State Legislature is exactly what this court said in Emory versus Hunt. Same thing you say at state A's. No do-overs. No do-overs. You get it right, it's like getting a hired hand. You fix that fence the first time I tell you, you fix it the way I told you, or I'll get somebody who can. No do-overs.
So you're saying that they had the tools in front of them to make a correct decision, and obviously they made the decision.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that the legal presumption under South Dakota case law is that they are presumed to be informed. The responsibility is not under the law to prove in a discrete and subjective analysis that every single voter was on the South Dakota Law Review. But they are presumed to know what had taken place, and that is in turn backed up by ample South Dakota history. And the history of South Dakota is, I'm quite proud of it.
So you're saying that the voters basically made a philosophical decision, and that was all they had to make when they voted no, was that the legislature gets one turn at bat, and if they strike out, then it goes to the Supreme Court.
No, I'm saying that historically, they said you're going to get one turn at bat, but it was even more specific than that by the time we got down to the ballot issue in 2002. So that language was very, very specific. It said, it again, in complete anticipation of our being here, this is law and politics meeting at the crossroads at its best or worst. And what did the people say? The people said, in the event a South Dakota state court judge or federal district court judge finds a redistricting plan to be invalid, the South Dakota state legislature will have the authority to reapportion outside of a decennial year. That language didn't clarify. Had they voted yes, we would all have to agree. Every jurist and every lawyer would have to agree. That would have completely reversed Kane versus Cundert. It would have reversed In Re Opinion of the Judges in 1933, and it would have reversed the certified question in Emory versus Hunt. And the people of South Dakota said no. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. In fact, there's ample wisdom in that. 16 states have commissions of one sort or another that assist. 4 states begin the redistricting process with a commission. It is not all that terribly unusual, but all we need is a whiff of Tom DeLay's cologne to know what the people of South Dakota wanted to resist in this case, and that is the continual and relentless, and the position taken by the Attorney General in this case is so dramatically at odds with the notes, and I have them here, they're quite interesting, the 5 pages of debate from the 1889 convention. What the people of South Dakota, or what the Attorney General is proposing, is that redistricting can take place even in the absence of a qualified census. It is an invitation to, well, if we were policymakers, and we're not, we're lawyers and jurists, it is an invitation to chaos. It is an invitation to year in, year out redistricting if the Attorney General's position in this case is adopted. People have spoken quite clearly. The South Dakota State Legislature, in the absence of another attempt to amend the Constitution, is deprived of the authority, completely so, to redistrict any time between now and 2011. The sole authority to redistrict on, in this case lies with Federal District Court Judge Karen Schreier.
Mr. Duffy, let me ask you this though. If it's so clear, if your position is so clear that this would require a constitutional amendment, and that it's not just a matter of clarifying, why didn't Judge Schreier simply follow the law that you're suggesting and say that the legislature has no power, so I'm going to do it? I mean, if it's this clear, it seems to me Judge Schreier wouldn't have asked us to clarify the matter.
I don't want to second guess Judge Schreier, but this began with a direct request from the governor to her immediately upon the loss of this case by the state to certify this question. Then the Attorney General made a request to have the question certified. And as I think you all know, and particularly if you've read Judge Schreier's opinion, it is without question one of the greatest federal district court voting rights opinions ever written. I could talk for days about the breakthrough nature of the application of from math to sociology of the law of voting rights to Indian country. But courts, federal district courts, have to be careful. They have to be certain. And if you really want my honest opinion about what I think she's doing, she's being very, very careful. Had she gone ahead and done what you have suggested and on her own said it is clear, she runs the risk of reversal.
Your time has expired, Mr. Duffy. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for allowing me to appear in front of you. I appreciate it very much.
Mr. Guin, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin with, what did the voters know? Because we just heard that Mr. Duffy seemed to imply that the voters knew a lot about Emery V. Hunt. I just opened the brief of the respondents, and I didn't see any reference at all that would demonstrate that a voter in the year 2002, that a voter in 2002 knew about Emery V. Hunt.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Duffy's approach that this is basically a philosophical question and no more? You didn't have to be a constitutional expert to vote on this issue. You simply decided how many turns at bat is the legislature going to get. One, and if they strike out, that's it, or do they get another turn at bat? He's saying that it's not that hard. It's just a simple philosophical question.
Well, it is not a simple philosophical question because it misreads what is in the text of the proposed constitutional amendment itself. And what it says is, what the proposed constitutional amendment text says is that if a reapportionment is declared to be invalid, the legislature shall apportion. It doesn't necessarily indicate the legislature doesn't have the power to do it. It says that the legislature shall do it. It's mandatory. It's not permissive. And it seems to me that the entire argument of that Mr. Bonshirt's been making is really based upon the theory that what the amendment's really permissive, but it isn't permissive, it's mandatory. So I think basically there's a misreading of the entire amendment from right out of the box. Secondly, we think it is important. If the voters are asked to clarify a constitutional amendment, they need to know what it is they're supposed to be clarifying. What is this all about? And what Mr. Duffy's saying today, what it's really all about is Emery V. Hunt. But Emery V. Hunt wasn't part of the debate, at least as far as he has had an opportunity to put before this court. And that was his time to do it in this brief. Wasn't there. So there's no record to support the implication, the inferences, the argument he's making. There's a second assumption that's sort of hidden beneath the argument of Mr. Duffy, and that is that the court already sort of answered this question in its 2000 opinion. But of course, it didn't do that. In the 2000 decision, the court specifically declined to answer the question of what happens when the legislature has apportioned and then a federal district court reapportions. The court went to some limit. It said exactly what question it was asking. Whether the South Dakota legislature acted in violation of Article 3, Section 5 when it redistricted in 1996. And then it said, at the end of the opinion, the specific state law question certified to this court has been answered. The certified question is answered in the affirmative. The court simply did not go beyond the boundaries of the question it was asked, as it was proper.
So you're saying that it's not necessary to overrule
No.
Emery versus Hunt
Absolutely
in order
not,
to reach the position that's in line with your position?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is not necessary to overrule Emery v. Hunt. I think this is completely in harmony with Emery v. Hunt, because Emery v. Hunt left this question open, and justifiably so, because the question wasn't before the court yet, like it is today. There's some reference made to the Attorney General's explanation that kind of goes back on what I've already said here. The Attorney General's explanation really does not add much to the analysis. What the Attorney General's explanation says is that if the legislative plan is invalidated by a court, the amendment would require the legislature to adopt a new plan. It does not address the question of whether the legislature has got the power in the first instance, nor does the text of the amendment. And it doesn't deny that the legislature already has that power, nor does the text of the amendment. So the Attorney General's opinion does not add much to the analysis in this particular case for those reasons. But what Mr. Duffy is essentially saying is, well, the title of this act was misleading, text was misleading, the explanation is misleading, and so the rejection of the amendment based on all this misleading stuff ought to be dispositive with regard to the interpretation of the Constitution. Your Honors, we would say that that is an absurd argument. The voters acted the best they could with the information they had. And with the information they had, they were simply unable, we think, to make a decent decision because all the facts had not been put before them. They didn't know anything about Emery B. Hunt. They didn't know anything about at least there's no evidence that they know anything about Emery B. Hunt. We're not referred to a single piece of evidence that they knew anything about Emery B. Hunt. All they were told is that the Constitution needed clarification. And that simply was not enough for them. And so we believe that they did the appropriate thing in that situation, that it was simply to reject the whole amendment. Your Honors, the basic principle of constitutional interpretation is set out in the 2000 opinion of this court. A legislature's got the power to act unless the Constitution forbids the exercise of that power. So there has to be something in the Constitution, and the burden is on Mr. Bonesher to show it, something in the Constitution to demonstrate that there's a constitutional restriction on the legislature's power to redistrict. The burden is on Mr. Bonesher to show that. Mr. Bonesher has got to be able to show there's no reasonable doubt that the proposed redistricting violates the Constitution. Mr. Bonesher has been unable to do so, and his claim should be rejected. No further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dune. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.